Well, starting last September, I taught a one-year graduate course in general relativity. So my task today is to condense that down to an hour. And clearly that's not an easy task, but I will try to emphasize just the main ideas and the basic tools that you'll need to understand the talks that follow in this workshop. So the outline is let me start with a couple references. There is a very good book by Jim Hartle called Gravity, which describes a lot of the physics, essentially all the important physics of general relativity, without a lot of the background mathematics, without going into a lot of the tensor calculus that most GR books start with. If you want a more complete treatment, there's a book by Sean Carroll called Space-Time in Geometry. Okay, so the outline is I thought I'd start with saying just a few words about special relativity, just so we all start on the same page. I'll then describe general relativity, talk about the main application here, which is black holes. Parts 2 and 3 will be the main body of the seminar, but at the end I hope to have time to say a few words about anti-de Sitter space, which is the famous ADS, half of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Okay, so, no, I don't need that. As you know, in special relativity, space and time are unified. That means that if you take two events and look at their separation, we usually talk about their spatial separation and the time elapsed between them, but special relativity tells us that those are not invariant concepts. Different observers will get different answers for the spatial separation and time elapsed. There's one invariant distance between two events, which is this quantity, the combination of c squared times the time elapsed plus the spatial distance squared. Now, we often set the speed of light equal to 1, in other words, measuring time in units of centimeters, the same as we measure space. So a centimeter of time is just the time it takes light to travel a centimeter, 10 to the minus 10 seconds. And we also often write this in the form where eta is just the constant matrix with minus 1, 1, 1, 1 along the diagonal, and zeros off the diagonal. And I have adopted here a convention which all relativists use, starting with Einstein, that repeated indices are summed over. So the indices mu and nu here run from 0, 1, 2, 3, which cover the time and the three space coordinates, and repeated indices are summed. Particles in special relativity follow world lines. So the world lines are specified by giving all four coordinates as a function of some arbitrary parameter lambda. The tangent vector to the world line is just the time derivative of this, or the derivative of x with respect to the parameter lambda. Null massless particles, like photons, satisfy are particles whose world line has zero length, in the sense that this tangent vector satisfies the condition that its length with respect to the metric eta is zero. And the set of all null or massless particles, so these are massless particles satisfying this, this is what we call null world lines. And the set of all such world lines starting from a single point give you the light cone. So we have from any point a future light cone and a past light cone. The future light cone is just the result of sending off a flash of light This, of course, is the standard space-time diagram with time plotted vertical, space horizontal. You set off a flash of light at one event, P here. It expands in space, of course, in time. And so this is the future light cone. Past light cone is a shell of light set up initially just to converge right on you at an event P. Massive particles follow world lines which are time-like. They have to lie inside the light cone. So they have a condition that their tangent vector has a length which is always negative, saying that it is traveling less than the speed of light. So they follow curves which stay inside the light cone. The total length of a time-like curve is the total proper time, and the proper time is just the integral over the curve. This is the length squared, indicated by ds squared. The tangent vector has a negative length, so we take minus the square root of this. Okay, so you add up all the little bits of proper time along the curve. This is the total proper time along the curve. This is the physical time that you experienced. This governs how your watch moves. It governs how your heart beats. It is physical proper time. And it's one of the main lessons of special relativity, which has been confirmed over and over again by experiment, that the time you experience does depend on your state of motion. Something which is very counterintuitive, but the way the world is. Okay. With that lightning review of special relativity, I'd now like to... I should say, I mean, feel free to ask questions. I mean, this is really supposed to be for you to learn something. I know I'm going to have to go rather quickly, but I do welcome questions. Okay, general relativity. The key idea of general relativity is that since gravity is universal, it affects all objects in exactly the same way, we should identify it with something else which is universal, namely the geometry of space and time itself. So gravity is equivalent to space-time geometry. I should mention that general relativity is not a theory of acceleration. It's clear that in special relativity, we can talk about accelerated observers with no problem at all. Non-accelerated observers, the inertial observers, are just straight lines. But we can take any world line in special relativity. We have a well-defined proper time. We can talk about observations made by accelerated observers. It's all perfectly consistent and describable by special relativity. General relativity is important when you talk about gravity, the theory of gravity. Okay, so what does it mean that you've identified gravity with space-time geometry? It means that the metric on space-time, the metric giving the distance between nearby events, is no longer required to take this simple a to mu nu form. Instead, we allow the metric to depend on your four space-time coordinates. And we write a general metric like that. Now, once you have allowed the metric to be a function of x, there's clearly a large redundancy because you can label your points with different sets of coordinates. So there's a coordinate freedom here. If you pick one set of coordinates, x mu, and write the metric in this way, somebody else could come along and say, OK, I'm going to choose another set of coordinates, x tilde of mu, which are a function of your coordinates. And as long as these functions are smooth, so you can differentiate them, and invertible, they're perfectly good coordinates. And yet the form of these metric functions will certainly change when you start changing your coordinates. So this freedom to change your coordinates is the gauge freedom of general relativity. It's just like, you know, UN of gauge theories. So this coordinate freedom is the gauge freedom. So to describe the geometry in a more invariant way, we want to talk about the curvature. One way of getting a handle on the curvature, well, so the simple standard example is to consider a sphere. So let's consider starting with a point on the equator with the vector tangent to the equator. And I want to move along a curve, keeping the vector parallel to itself. So if you do that, you just take the vector, you move it along the equator, keeping it parallel to itself. Now let me go up a line of longitude here, keeping the vector parallel to itself. And now let me come back along a different line of longitude. Coming back to the same point I started with, and you see that the vector has rotated. So the amount that the vector rotates is a measure of the curvature of the sphere. Now, we would like to use that idea in a more local way, because we want to get a local measure of the curvature near any point of space and time. So the way to do that is to consider not a big loop, like I've drawn here on the sphere, but a little tiny infinitesimal loop. So if you think about a small loop, that can be characterized by two vectors, because you have a vector, say, v1, and another vector, v2. And you can consider the loop where you go, you know, along v1, and then along v2, and then back along, you know, minus v1, and then back along minus v2. So you have a little loop characterized by two vectors. And I want to take another vector at this initial point and move it around the loop, keeping it parallel to itself. And as this example shows, we expect the vector to come back rotated. But of course, this is a loop not just in space, but in space-time. So the rotation can actually involve Lorentz transformations. It can come back boosted as well as rotated. So we're going to get an element of the Lorentz group, or little, you know, element of the Lorentz group, and those are generated by antisymmetric tensors. So we get an antisymmetric tensor. So the vector is rotated and boosted by an amount which is an antisymmetric tensor. But of course, it also depends on your loop. It depends on which little loop you chose to move your vector around. So I need to put that information in. And so what you see is that the curvature is really described by an object with four indices. Two indices are sort of telling you or allowing you to input which loop you want to move your vector around. And the other two indices are telling you which Lorentz transformation that vector gets rotated and boosted by. So this four-index object, which has all the information about the curvature of our space-time, is called the Riemann curvature tensor. There is an explicit formula you can write down for it, which just tells you that this is given by I won't write out the whole formula, but it's basically two derivatives of the metric plus first derivatives of the metric squared. You can work that out. So it's given by some explicit formula in terms of this metric here. You can now take traces of the curvature to get pieces of the curvature. The metric g mu nu is been introduced here. The inverse of g mu nu, just thought of as an ordinary matrix, it's a 4x4 invertible matrix. The inverse of this matrix is denoted g upper mu nu. That's just our convention. Why introduce another letter when you don't have to? So we just write the same g with the upper indices to denote the inverse. Okay, so in particular, so g mu nu, g nu rho is just the usual Kronecker delta. And we're going to use this inverse to get pieces of the curvature. So the Ricci curvature is a two-index tensor, which is obtained by taking your full curvature and contracting it with this inverse metric. Okay, so that's just a two-index tensor, again constructed from second derivatives of the metric. And finally, you can do that again and get the scalar curvature . And the scalar curvature is, as the name says, just a function on space and time. And that is what you get when you take the Ricci tensor and contract with this inverse metric. So now I want to say a word about integration on a space with a curve metric. Of course, yeah.
How do I actually measure this in different parts of the
One way of measuring the curvature is if you start with two initially parallel lines, and I'll tell you more precisely what I mean by a line in a minute, but if you start with two initially parallel lines in a space with curvature, they don't stay parallel. So by looking at how they deviate, either expanding or contracting, you can... Right. Let's see. I mean, right. But let's see. So physically, you want to take a measurement. I can tell you in more detail later, but it's not that all your measuring apparatus change in exactly the same way as the sort of distance between your GD6, so it's all invisible. I mean, that's not the way it works. Okay, so you actually can, you know, take two parallel lines and see that they're closer together with the meter sticks that you get at that later point, and they do change. So we can do it. Okay, so I want to say a word about integration, because I need that in order to tell you what the action is in the field equations for general relativity. So in general relativity, it doesn't make sense to integrate a function in the way you would think to do. You can't just take your function and integrate d4x, because this quantity is coordinate dependent. Its value will change if you change your coordinates. So this is coordinate dependent. So what you need is to introduce a proper four volume to get a well-defined integral. So you need What do I mean by the proper four volume? Well, let's assume for simplicity that the metric is diagonal. So let's suppose that the metric takes just the form, well, there's minus some, well, okay, gtt dt squared, gxx, dx squared, gyy, dy squared, and gzz, and dz squared, where these g's can be functions of t, x, y, and z. They can be arbitrary functions. Okay, so what's the proper length of a curve that's only in the x direction? So the proper length in the x direction, well, if you imagine holding t fixed and y fixed and z fixed, then these terms don't contribute. This is the only contribution to the length squared. So the proper length in the x direction is clearly the square root of gxx. So this is square root of gxx dx. The proper area in the xy plane . Well, again, we're going to keep t fixed and z fixed, so these terms don't contribute. And now you can just consider a little square with a certain extent in x and a certain extent in y. Clearly, if this is the length in the x direction, the length in the y direction is square root of y, square root of gyy times dy. And so the area is just the product. And so you get the square root of gxx times gyy times dx dy. And clearly, continuing in this way, you see that the proper four volume is then the square root of all of these components. But we have to remember that GTT is negative. This is a metric which is not positive definite. Like it in special relativity, it's not positive definite. So we need to put the minus sign in there. And then this is GTT GXX. GYY and GZZ. Okay, so that's the proper four volume. So that strongly suggests that the proper four volume in general, that's the result for a diagonal metric, but this is just the determinant of the metric, the product of the diagonal elements. So in general, we need the square root of minus the determinant of g mu nu, and this is usually abbreviated to be just minus g. Okay. And indeed, this is the integral of a function times square root of minus the determinant of the metric integrated over all coordinates is invariant under your choice of coordinates. This thing ends up giving you exactly the right Jacobian so that it gives you the right change, you know, it transforms appropriately when you change variables. Okay, so this is invariant. Okay. So now I can tell you what the action of general relativity is and what the field equations are. The simplest action you can think of, which involves two derivatives of the metric, would be, okay, so what do we have, which is a measure of the geometry with two derivatives of the metric? Well, that's, of course, the curvature. We want to integrate a function, so we take the scalar curvature. And so we just take the scalar curvature with the proper volume, integrate over space and time, and that is indeed the action of general relativity. That's the so-called Einstein-Hilbert action. When you extremize it with respect to the metric, you get an equation which is r mu nu minus a half the trace, well, half the scalar curvature times g mu nu equals 0. And this is the Einstein field equation in the absence of matter, the vacuum field equation. It's actually very easy to derive this. The scalar curvature I told you is just the Ricci tensor. There it is. The Ricci tensor times the inverse metric. So when you vary the metric here, the inverse metric, there's a term here which clearly is the variation of the inverse metric times the Ricci tensor. When you vary the volume element, you get minus a half the Lagrangian, this function back again, times the metric, and that's it. Now you might think that there's another term, which of course is the dependence of the Ricci tensor on the metric itself. That would look like it's the hard part. That term ends up giving you a total derivative, which doesn't contribute to the field equation at all. So it's really that easy to derive Einstein's equation. So this is the so-called vacuum field equation. Now, there are two modifications of this that people sometimes consider. One is, if you want to consider an action which has two derivatives of the metric, I said this is the simplest one, but you could throw in a constant. So you could consider an action which is the scalar curvature minus a constant, which is conventionally written as 2 lambda. The field equation you get now is, well, you get the same terms you had before. Okay, so this implies the extrema are now the terms you had before, plus this constant times the metric. This is the famous cosmological constant. This is the term that Einstein added to his field equation a couple of years after he first proposed this, when he realized that his field equations would not allow for a static universe, a static cosmology. He later renounced them as the biggest mistake of his life, but as you all know, they're one of the main, most important questions in physics today is to understand the observed apparent non-zero value of this, this constant. Okay, of course you can also add matter. So far we've only talked about gravity. This is just the curvature and this extra constant piece. Yes? Absolutely. So there are, of course, higher powers of the curvature that you could add. And string theory, in fact, predicts that the full, complete theory of gravity is not exactly general relativity, but does, in fact, have r squared and higher powers of the curvature in it as some, you know, if you go to higher energies or higher curvatures where they would be important. So these are the leading term at low energies. No. Okay, in four dimensions, there are a couple, two actually independent topological terms, but they both involve two powers of the curvature. So in four dimensions, there's nothing. In two dimensions, this term itself is topological. Okay, so that's the case where you actually do have a topological term at this order, but that's just saying that general relativity is trivial in two dimensions, because you can show that in two dimensions, this equation is always satisfied. In 2 plus 1, there's no topological term of this order. Okay, there is, of course, an analog of the Chern-Simons term for gravity that people sometimes add. There's been a lot of interest in that recently, the so-called topologically massive gravity theories that people have been talking about recently. It's not general relativity. Okay, it's just some extension. Exactly. And in this three-dimensional gravity dual to a two-dimensional CFT, yeah, those sort of things, you know, could be discussed. Okay, so you can of course add matter as well, and so then you would have an action. Now I have to put in Newton's constant. You can put any matter you want. You can have Maxwell field, scalars, fermions, whatever. But you have some action or a Lagrangian for the matter, which of course depends on your space-time metric. You simply add that to the Einstein action, and then you get a field equation. Well, of course, this doesn't depend on the matter, so you get field equations for your matter. But then in addition, Einstein's equation now gives you this same combination of curvature minus same combination of curvature, and this gives you 8 pi g times the stress energy tensor of the matter. And that's Einstein's equation in the presence of matter. One last thing I want to say about general relativity before I turn to black holes, and that is a statement about the motion of test particles. So to explore the consequences of a particular geometry, you often make an approximation that you're considering probes or particles that don't back react on the geometry. Their mass is much less than whatever star or black hole or, that's causing the space-time to curve in the first place. In this test particle approximation, the world lines that the particles follow are, in some sense, the straightest possible curves in this curved space, and they're curves called geodesics. So test particles follow geodesics. And you can think of the geodesic in two different ways. You can think of it as a curve so that if you take the tangent vector at one point and move it along the curve, keeping it parallel to itself, it will stay, in fact, tangent to the curve. So the tangent vector, sort of stays parallel it's easy to illustrate this in flat space. In flat space, if you have a curve like this and you start with the tangent vector here and you move it parallel to itself, it's clearly not tangent to the curve anymore at this point. And so that's the statement that in flat space the only geodesics are in fact the straight lines. So in curved space, straight line is not so well defined, but there's nevertheless curves so that the tangent vector, if you transport it parallel to itself, stays tangent to the curve. The other way to think about a geodesic is that it's the curves which extremize their proper time. So I had that formula before. In special relativity, I wrote down a formula for the proper time along any curve, just some integral of the square root of the metric. There's some exactly analogous formula in general relativity. You just replace that eta mu nu with g mu nu, and you get the proper time for a general curve. And the geodesics are the curves which extremize it. It's the analog of the statement that in a positive definite space, the shortest distance between the two points the geodesics are the shortest distance between two points. In relativity, for time-like curves, they're actually the longest proper time between two events are the geodesics. Okay, so I think we're about ready to discuss black holes. If you are talking about time-like geodesics, or the motion of actual massive particles, yes, the extremum is usually a maximum of that proper time. No, because given any two events, so here's an event to the future of this one, and here's a sort of candidate geodesic. If you want to look for a curve which has shorter proper time, you just make it more null. So here's a curve, so here's a null curve, which is the motion of a light ray out to here and another light ray up to there, that would have zero length. So you can always take your time-like curves to get closer and closer to that, and so the minimum would be zero. And those are not geodesics if they stay close to the light cone. So it's always a maximum. Okay, so number three. Lines. Just months after Einstein had his final form of general relativity and wrote down this equation, Karl Schwarzschild found an exact solution, an exact nonlinear solution of this equation, now known as the Schwarzschild solution. And it's a metric, which looks like the following. OK, d omega is just the usual spherical volume element. So maybe I should write it out once so there'll be no confusion. It's just d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So it's incredibly simple. Depends on one parameter, m. Clearly, when m is 0, you get just the flat space of special relativity, the Minkowski metric. For any m, if r is big enough, this term again goes away, and you recover the flat space of special relativity at large distance. M is, as the name suggests, a measure of the mass. So m is related to the mass. It is the mass if we set Newton's constant equal to 1. So in general relativity, it's a geometric theory. We like to measure everything in units of length. So I've already set c equal to 1, so time is measured in units of length. If we set g equal to 1, then mass is measured in units of length. And the conversion factor is turns out to be 1 centimeter of mass is about 10 to the 27 grams. It's the mass of the Earth. Okay, so it's a huge unit of mass. But anyway, it's convenient to set g equal to 1, and we don't have to keep factors of g all over. There is a theorem known as Birkhoff's theorem. So the metric clearly is static. Nothing depends on t, and it's spherically symmetric, because you have the usual round two spheres at every constant r and constant t. So the metric is static and spherically symmetric. And its interpretation, when it was first introduced, was that this is the geometry outside of a static spherical star. So geometry outside static spherical star. That's right. There's no matter here. So this is a solution outside the star. So it's a vacuum solution. So this is a Schwarzschild solution. It has t mu nu equals 0. Exactly. We're going to talk about it. There's clearly something funny which happens when r is equal to 2m. Okay, and, right, so we're going to have to talk about that. But for the moment, yes, it's a solution. Everywhere where it makes sense, it's a vacuum solution with no stress tensor. So this is how it was first studied, as a solution outside of a static spherical star. And this is where the classic tests of general relativity were done. So by looking at geodesics in this geometry, so the classic tests of GR, so this include the bending of light. This, of course, now is a tool that all astronomers use in gravitational lensing as a tool to probe the distant universe. There's also a gravitational redshift. The energy of a photon emitted at some finite r and is pointing outward to larger r actually goes down. The photon loses energy as it climbs out of the potential well of the star. In fact, just like a massive particle would as it was climbing out in Newtonian gravity. And then there's the motion of planets. by looking at geodesics in this particular geometry, you discover that the orbits are not exact ellipses. The ellipse doesn't close, so the orbit comes back a little bit shifted from where it started. There's a precession of the perihelion of the orbit. This was known before general relativity, for the planet Mercury at least, 43 seconds of arc per century, and general relativity explained it, because in Schwarzschild, if you take m equal to the mass of the sun, you look at what the orbits do, and you get exactly the observed amount for Mercury. Okay, so these are now well studied, well confirmed. General relativity has been tested to like 1 part in 10 to the 5, and it's all in agreement with the theory. In fact, the GPS, which is in such common use, wouldn't work if general relativity was not taken into account. This gravitational redshift, clocks run slower when they're deeper in the potential well. Yes? I will do one calculation in Euclidean signature in just a little bit. Physically, we believe the signature of the metric of the real world is Minkowski. So, but if you want to do Euclidean stat mech, we can do Euclidean GR. That's also it. Both are used. Yes, and the main property is the one I'm going to tell you about. Okay. Yeah, we're getting there. Okay, so this is the story as it was fully interpreted. But this solution, this remarkably simple exact solution of general relativity, is full of surprises. And I'm going to tell you about 3 or 4 of them. So first of all, suppose we have a, okay, so you might worry about this funny thing when r is equal to 2m. For stars, that's totally irrelevant because the surface of the star is much, much bigger. Well, I told you, you know, the mass of the Earth only corresponds to a centimeter. So putting in the mass of the sun, you get out to a kilometer or so. Surface of the star is much, much bigger than that. So we don't have to worry about it then. But suppose the star uses up its nuclear fuel and undergoes gravitational collapse. What's going to happen then? Well, in the process of collapsing, the star is certainly not static anymore. So you might think that this solution is just irrelevant. But there's a theorem called Birkhoff's theorem, which says that you don't have to assume static. The only spherically symmetric vacuum solution is Schwarzschild. The only spherically symmetric vacuum solution is Schwarzschild. Okay, so the metric is not going to change. It's going to stay in this form as the star undergoes gravitational collapse. The radius gets smaller and smaller and eventually falls inside this r equal to 2m surface. So then we really have to face what this means. And to understand that, we have to distinguish two types of singularities that can appear in general relativity. We have to distinguish singularities of the geometry. So we have actual curvature singularities and coordinate singularities. These are just places where our coordinates are going bad, and the geometry is perfectly fine. One way to distinguish between them is to compute some curvature invariant. Now, to do this, well, to include all aspects of the curvature, you want the whole curvature and square it. So by this, I mean you use the inverse metric to raise all these indices, or you take 2 powers of the curvature and contract all 4 indices with inverse metrics. But basically, you construct the square of the curvature, and you discover that this is m squared over r to the 6th. So it is perfectly finite at any finite r like 2m. So what this is telling us is that r equal to 2m is a coordinate singularity But clearly, R equals 0 is a curvature singularity. So we're not going to get rid of the singularity at R equal to 0, which occurs here, but we should be able to get rid of the singularity at R equal to 2m if we just change our coordinates. How do we find good coordinates? You base them on something physical, like the motion of ingoing light rays. So let's do that. So we can introduce a coordinate which is constant along ingoing light rays. So let V label ingoing light rays. And then in sort of VR theta and phi. So we're going to replace T with V. And in these coordinates, we get the following picture of this collapse. So we have a star, which is a big ball collapsing down. According to general relativity, it collapses down to zero radius. The density becomes infinite, and we get this curvature singularity at R equal to 0, which we denote by this squiggly line. We also have a surface out here, which actually comes in, well, what's that? Am I what? These. I'm going to, what are the axes? Basically, I'm going to tell you what the light cones are doing in a minute. And once I tell you what the light cones are doing, you'll see which direction is time and which direction is space. Roughly, this is time, initially at least, because this is the star getting big in the past and collapsing down. I'm just trying to say, so here's the matter. This is some light cone inside the star, which is expanding out, but eventually there's so much matter inside that the bending of light stops the light cone from expanding. And it basically stops expanding and stays at some constant R, which is in fact, so this is the surface R equal to 2m. Now what else is going on? Well, we have ingoing light rays. So here's our ingoing light ray. This is some V equals constant surface. And now I have to tell you what the outgoing light ray is. The outgoing light rays far away look normal. They're just like the flat space light ray, light cones that we had in special relativity. But as you move in, the outgoing light ray gets pulled more and more vertical. And so here it's a little bit vertical. And at this point, the outgoing light ray is actually sitting right here at R equal to 2m. That is the outgoing light ray. If you go inside, the outgoing light ray is actually going in. Okay. Now, you know that you can't travel faster than light. So all world lines must stay inside their local light cone. So what this is telling you is that once you fall past this surface, R equal to 2m, there's no way to escape. You're forced to follow inside the light cone and hit the singularity at R equal to 0. So this surface, this null surface at R equal to 2m, is the event horizon. And the entire region, the entire four-dimensional space-time inside R equal to 2m, is the black hole. So R less than 2m is the black hole. Go on. There's another way to picture this black hole, which is sometimes a little bit clearer for causal questions. You can require that all light rays are at 45 degrees. In special relativity, things are easy. Light rays are always at 45 degrees. Here I'm talking about the light rays being tipped and tipped and tipped. You can say, suppose I insist that light rays always travel along 45 degree lines. What does this look like? And what it looks like is the following. Okay, so here's our star collapsing down as before. This is r equal to 0. It's the center of the star, which was just in the center here. This obviously has spherical symmetry. Now I'm sort of suppressing that rotational direction. Each point represents a sphere of a radius. So r equals 0 is here. But up here, the singularity is also r equal to 0. This null line here, which I guess I should call pink, be consistent with that. This is r equal to 2m. And, okay, so I guess I should have drawn it a little bit earlier, but you can see the same physics. Light rays are now at 45 degrees, so once you cross this null surface, you have to follow inside your light cone, and you're not going to get back out to any point out here. So this is just another way of picturing the black hole. This is called an Eddington diagram. This is called a Kruskal diagram, but it's all the same physics. Now, okay, so Schwarzschild, that simple-looking solution up there, not only describes physics outside static stars, like the sun, and gave us all our classic tests, it also gives us a picture of a black hole. But it does more, because suppose we remove the matter. Suppose we say, okay, let's look at this vacuum solution and just extend it as far as we can and see what the whole space-time looks like with no matter. Well, then we get another surprise. With no matter, this is still Schwarzschild. The picture now looks like this. So each point, again, represents a two-sphere. This is r equal to 2m. This is r equal to 2m. This is r equal to 0. And that's r equal to 0. OK, so each point is an S2 with some radius. What's going on here? Well, one is just like the exterior region outside the black hole. So this is the region 1 is the usual exterior that we've seen before. Region 2 is the usual black hole. Okay, so this is part of region 2 here. We took out the matter and we just extended it as much as we could. So this is the black hole. 3 is the time reverse of the black hole. It's an object which it's easy to get out. Right? The light cones look like this. If you're in here, you go right out, no trouble. You can't fall in. Right? If you're out here, you can't fall in. So this is a white hole. It's the time reverse of a black hole. It's called a white hole. And finally, there's another region over here, which actually is an identical copy of region 1. So on this other side of this space-time, there's another asymptotically flat region. We can get far away. The metric becomes flat. And it's just basically another exterior sort of geometry. You might have heard of wormholes. This is an example of a kind of wormhole where you have an asymptotically a big region here, you can somehow go through this small region and end up in another big region over there. Unfortunately, there's no way to communicate with anybody living on the other side, because any signal here, of course, has to travel inside 45 degree lines, and you see it can never reach anybody over in region 4. That's what the mathematics, that's Schwarzschild in its full glory. It is not physical, I should say. We believe, yeah? Right. Good question. It is still interpreted as the total mass, in the sense that if you have this geometry and you go a distance and you put planets in orbit around this thing, that's the mass it will see. So it's still interpreted, acts like a total mass. But you're right, the matter has somehow been removed from the space, and instead you have this funny topology where, you know, this is not your usual R4 anymore. You have some funny wormhole here. There need not be any matter. That is true. You can have, you certainly don't know. If you see test particles moving in some nice, you know, Newtonian orbits, you don't know if it's a big fat star or a very collapsed black hole. That's for sure. The black hole doesn't pull any harder. But you also don't know, in principle, and I just said this is unphysical, but in principle you could have something like this where there's no matter anywhere. The reason this is unphysical, so before you get too excited or too confused, I should point out that the reason it's unphysical is because of this initial condition here. So this space-time requires a singularity in its past, which is exactly the time reverse of your black hole singularity. That's very special initial conditions. It's not the way we believe the universe was created. So this is more of mathematical interest than physical interest. But still, it's another surprise that the Schwarzschild geometry has for us. Now, you... Well, there is an issue of stability of these white holes, but I think more basic than saying, given nice smooth initial data, is it stable or unstable? This requires very peculiar initial conditions, right? So this is not even, you can't start the universe in some nice, state and expect this to form. It's just not part of the Big Bang. All right, you might think that I've spent too much time talking about just the simplest black hole solution. What about all the others? Well, there aren't any. Okay? There's a uniqueness theorem. Well, okay, you've seen this long enough. There's the so-called black hole uniqueness theorem, which says that if you look for static black holes, the only static asymptotically flat, okay, so we have our usual boundary condition at infinity that there's no matter or anything else out there, static asymptotically flat black hole is Schwarzschild, is the one that we've been talking about. You can form a black hole in many different ways. Take stars with arbitrary multiple moments, etc. Let it collapse, wait for it to settle down. If the black hole isn't rotating, I'm assuming it's static, which means no rotation, and I'm assuming there's no charge or any electromagnetic fields around. If it's static and vacuum, asymptotically flat vacuum, black hole, it's got to be Schwarzschild. So this is the famous uniqueness theorem for black holes, which led to the idea that black holes have no hair. This was Wheeler's idea that unlike all the distinguishing characteristics that stars could have that you could measure at infinity, various multiple moments or things, there are very few, there's essentially no distinguishing characteristics of static black holes. That's when this was further supported, this idea that black holes have no hair, was supported when people looked at simple matter fields propagating in the black hole background. So you can add scalar fields or just electromagnetic waves. And what they found, the scalar field always falls into the black hole or radiates off to infinity. So at late times, the scalar field is gone. The electromagnetic waves are gone. So basically, even when you add simple matter fields, the only solution was Schwarzschild. Now, it's been discovered more recently that if you add more interesting nonlinear matter fields, there are certain cases where black holes can have hair. And we'll hear more about it in this program because they play an important role in these holographic superconductors. Right, so angular momentum is another property that black holes certainly can carry. There is a generalization of the Schwarzschild solution which describes a rotating black hole. That's also known to be unique. It has only two parameters, the mass and angular momentum. So it's similarly unique, but of course angular momentum is a conserved quantity, and the black holes certainly carry it. Oh, how do you measure it? So it can be read off from the asymptotic form of the metric. So typically, so you want sort of an experimentalist. Yeah, it affects the orbits. It affects the orbits. Certainly there's an angular momentum coupling. Yeah, spin orbit coupling sort of thing. So you get the spin of the black hole couples to your angular momentum of your orbit and modifies it a bit. So. So I'm going to almost be done. I guess I wanted to say one more word about black holes before moving on to say a few words about anti-de Sitter in closing. So far I've talked about vacuum solutions, and we've talked about Schwarzschild and all of its amazing properties. If you assume that you have a Maxwell field and you have electric charges, then of course the black hole can be charged. So the charged black hole, before I do this, I have to tell you one more and very important thing about black holes. Yes? No. Sorry. What I meant was this extension, this maximal extension of Schwarzschild with no matter is not physical. This is perfectly physical. This is perfectly physical. This we expect to have happened many, many times in our universe. There are black holes all over the place. People have seen it. This is unphysical. All these regions 3 and 4 are unphysical. But 1 and 2 are most definitely physical. Okay, so this is certainly the way we think things really are. All black holes which are not rotating and which have no charge are described by this solution. So there are extensions to allow angular momentum for rotation and charge. Yes, there are. It's not believed that physical astrophysical black holes have a lot of charge, because black holes will tend to neutralize themselves by attracting oppositely charged particles. So the physical black holes are most likely electrically neutral, but they definitely have angular momentum. And astrophysicists are now in the process of measuring the angular momentum of certain black holes. And it's tentative, but they're getting some interesting results. Yes?
If the black hole uses angular momentum to,
Yes, and I'm coming to that.
And yeah. Tends to lose
angular momentum faster. So it spins down as it Hawking radiates. Well, they both decay, but the angular momentum, if you start with a very rapidly rotating black hole, it will certainly evolve to something which is less rapidly rotating as it Hawking radiates. Okay, so that's a perfect lead in. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
It's hard to do in a nonlinear theory like general relativity. Okay, so it's very hard to interpret the singularity in Schwarzschild as just some delta function source. I mean, you think it should be, right? Because you have your matter that's been squashed down, somehow that should be the source of it. But it's a little bit different because, as you can tell here, the matter collapses down and might explain this part of the singularity, but there's another singularity up here which doesn't seem to be touched by the matter. So it's a little tricky. But besides, this whole idea of trying to use delta functions is not really well defined when you have nonlinear field equations. Yeah? You will certainly have black holes in a wide variety of theories of gravity. So you can add to Einstein action various terms involving the square of the curvature, and the Schwarzschild solution is still a solution. So it's not just a solution of Einstein gravity. It's a solution of lots of other things. But if you ask me, could I think of a theory where the Schwarzschild solution is not a solution, I probably could. So it's not sort of guaranteed, but it is a solution for many, many theories of gravity. Yeah, maybe there's field redefinition. It's not a well-defined question, exactly. No, because I'm already over time, and I have two more important things to say. Okay, so one important thing was mentioned, this Hawking radiation business. Yes? There can certainly be more complicated singularities. So the Big Bang is, in some sense, a singularity which occurs everywhere in space, at one time. So, yeah, the singularity can be of various types. Oh, yeah. Okay, Hawking radiation. So black holes, as I just said, were things where objects can fall in, but nothing can come out. That's classically. Hawking showed back in 1974 that when you couple matter quantum mechanically to a black hole, then black holes radiate at essentially a thermal spectrum with a temperature. So the Hawking radiation from a black hole. So there's thermal radiation with a temperature which is, it's quantum mechanical, it's proportional to h bar, and it's divided by 8 pi times the mass of the black hole. Now let me tell you how to calculate this. Well, I was told to do a calculation involving Euclidean metric. So, I will tell you how to calculate this because it's really very easy. Hawking calculated it at first by doing some quantum field theory calculation in curved space-time. There's a much simpler way, which Hawking realized just a few years later in work with Gary Gibbons. You analytically continue the Schwarzschild metric, that same metric which was doing everything for us, also gives us the Hawking temperature in a very simple way. So you take T, you let it go to I times some Euclidean time, you then have a metric which is now plus 1 minus 2m over r d tau squared. The rest of the metric hasn't changed. R squared times the spherical element. Now you take a, so now we have to decide what to do at r equal to 2m, because again, that looks sort of funny. But you can do a coordinate transformation. Let r equal to 2m plus rho squared over 8m. If you make that simple coordinate transformation in this metric, this term turns into just d rho squared, and the metric becomes d rho squared plus rho squared d tau over 4m squared plus, well, basically just 2m squared d omega. So this is near r equal to 2m. So what this is telling us is that this Euclidean metric now is essentially a product of a sphere, a true sphere with radius r equal to 2m, and flat Euclidean plane, provided that tau, our Euclidean time, is periodically identified with the right period. So if we periodically identify, so if tau has period beta equal to h bar over 8 pi m, oh, I guess this is 1. Okay, we don't. All right, if it has period, if tau has period 8 pi m, that's better. If it has period 8 pi m, then clearly this quantity, tau over 4 pi, has period 2 pi. And so you get a nice smooth origin. But temperature is related to the periodicity of your Euclidean time by a standard formula, basically h bar over the period. And so you see you recover Hawking's temperature from the smoothness of the Euclidean geometry. If you want to think of it as an instanton, it has been interpreted as a probability to nucleate black holes. If you start with the hot gas in and you want to say, okay, I have a flat space with some gravitons at some temperature, and I want to calculate the probability of nucleating a black hole, that this sort of gas will form a black hole. That's been one of the interpretations of this Euclidean instanton. But I think it's better to think of it just as a way of showing that not only simple linear fields that Hawking was able to calculate, but any nonlinear interacting field theory you put on Schwarzschild is going to see the black hole as having a temperature equal to this, because this is the intrinsic temperature of the geometry of the black hole. That's right. Yeah, except it's not just a coordinate singularity. This is like a conical singularity. It's like taking the plane and identifying, you know, phi with period different from 2 pi. So it's not a coordinate effect. You're actually getting a conical singularity in the geometry. It would be like a delta function in the curvature at the tip of the cone. Right.
You can also think of it as saying that periodically identifying the Euclidean time, it's like coupling the system to a thermal bath. And then you're trying to figure out what's the right temperature of the thermal bath for it to be in equilibrium with the black hole, and that's just going to be when the two things are at the same temperature. So if the bath is at the temperature of the black hole, it's a nice, smooth Euclidean solution so it's in equilibrium.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure this is exactly the same calculation, but there were calculations which told us we were safe. Okay, not only do black holes have a temperature, they have an entropy. So the black hole entropy was first discussed by Bekenstein and later by Hawking. That is, turns out to be the area of the event horizon divided by 4. So this is the area of the event horizon divided by 4 in Planck units. So if I put the G's H bar back in, you get a formula like this. Now you can ask where this comes from. There's various ways to motivate it. One is just from an analog of the first law of thermodynamics. One can show quite generally that for black holes, if you have a black hole and you change its mass by a little bit, there's a formula which says that the change in the mass is related to the change of the area of the event horizon by just the expected dm is TdS type formula, where this is the Hawking temperature and this is the black hole entropy. If you plug numbers in, put a solar mass black hole, this temperature is incredibly cold. 10 to the minus 7 degrees Kelvin is the temperature of a typical solar mass black hole. The corresponding entropy is huge. It's 10 to the 77 in units where Boltzmann's constant is 1. So one of the successes of string theory is to understand a microscopic origin of that huge density of states for black holes in certain special cases. I'm really almost out of time, but I promised to say a word about ADS, so maybe I should do that. Sorry for running over, but the wine and cheese hasn't started yet. All right, anti-de Sitter, what is that all about? Anti-de Sitter space is the simplest solution of Einstein's equation with a negative cosmological constant. So we're now going to put that lambda cosmological constant into Einstein's equation and make it negative. It's the simplest solution, the maximally symmetric solution with lambda less than 0. And the metric looks like this. So it's also pretty simple. It has one parameter L, which is related to this constant in the action by L squared is minus 3 over lambda. And this is called the radius of curvature of anti-de Sitter space. A convenient way of thinking about anti-de Sitter space is to conformally rescale. If you multiply this metric, so you consider a rescaled metric, which I'll call S tilde squared, which is L squared over R squared. If you just conformally rescale, you don't change any of the causal relations, because light rays stay null if you rescale the metric. But it gives you a convenient way of thinking about this. This metric now is, it looks like minus dt squared plus L squared d omega plus dr squared over r to the fourth, L to the fourth, for large r. So this is approximately for large r. It looks like this. And so what you see is that, well, first of all, the distance out to r equals infinity is now finite. So you can get all the way out to infinity in a finite distance in this rescaled metric. And the metric at infinity, if you take r very large and constant, is just a cylinder. You have a sphere of radius L times time. So all of anti-de Sitter space really can be viewed as the inside of a cylinder, where on the boundary here, these are two spheres. I'm in four dimensions. Okay, so this is an S2, and this is time. Okay, so in the ADS-CFT correspondence, which you'll be hearing about, the field theory in some sense can be thought of as living on this finite cylinder, representing points at infinity. And as you can see, it's a finite distance away in this conformally rescaled metric, so light rays can certainly get out to infinity and come back, which means to evolve anything, you need to impose boundary conditions at infinity here to get well-defined evolution. The last thing I want to say is that most people don't write anti-de Sitter space in this form, because field theories or condensed matter systems don't usually live on spheres. You usually work on flat space. And there's a way of writing the anti-de Sitter metric so that the metric at infinity is naturally just flat Minkowski space. So it's simply a different choice of coordinates. So there's what's called Poincaré coordinates. These are global coordinates because they cover everything. Poincaré coordinates don't cover everything, but people don't seem to mind that so much. And the metric is just given by, so you choose a different, so the metric r tilde squared times minus dt squared plus dx. So you have just the flat metric, flat Minkowski metric on every constant radius surface. These are not the same coordinates as over there, but if you grant me that, I won't work for it. Okay, so these are Poincaré coordinates. So for a different time and a different radius, you can write the metric in this form. So constant radius surfaces look flat. The conformally scaling is just 1 over this radius, so now the metric at infinity really is flat. And you say, how is that related to this picture? And the answer is that these coordinates cover only one wedge. So you take your cylinder and you basically take a wedge through it like that. And these coordinates cover just this piece of the cylinder. This we thought of as going around and back. This is some big light cone. Constant radius surfaces look like this. And this boundary here is r equal to 0. This Poincaré radius equal to 0. That's where these coordinates break down. Anyway, this is a metric which you'll be hearing more about. It's just a piece of ADS in which we can do the ADS-CFT correspondence. And with 2 minutes to spare, I will now stop. Thank you. Thank you. more questions? The greatest thing about anti-de-Sitter space is that its boundary is timelike. So if you're going to think that there's some sort of holographic description of physics inside here in terms of some dual theory which lives off on your boundary at infinity, you can have a nice ordinary field theory living on the boundary. And this is a Lorentzian metric. It's just the, well, here it's just Minkowski space in one lower dimension. Here it's this, but that's an ordinary Lorentzian space. If you were to think about de-Sitter space, which I haven't talked about, the corresponding picture is one in which infinity, these boundary points, are space-like. So you would have to think that Lorentzian physics is somehow being encoded in some Euclidean field theory. People have tried to make that work because we see what appears to be a positive cosmological constant in nature. So it's not that people haven't tried, but it's much harder to make that sensible. Sure. So, this is a space of constant negative curvature. I didn't say that. I said it was just a solution of Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant, but it's actually much more. It has constant negative curvature, okay, which means that, so this, of course, is a Lorentzian metric. If we were to analytically continue and make it Euclidean, it would indeed be the usual hyperbolic geometry, the hyperbolic plane that is well studied by mathematicians. So it's a Lorentzian version of hyperbolic geometry. This is in four dimensions, in any dimension. There's generalizations of this to all dimensions. I was too sloppy. So here it appears as a scale, here. It's more important to put it here because here you might think you absorb it by rescaling your Minkowski coordinates. Here is what really tells you that you have some ADS radius. So it does appear in this metric as well. Right. Yes? Right. Funny you should ask. If you are in vacuum with no cosmological constant and no matter, the answer, unfortunately, is no. So if you look at three-dimensional vacuum general relativity, there is nothing that resembles a black hole. But if you add this negative cosmological constant, which is needed for ADS-CFT, the answer is yes. So there is something called a BTZ black hole for the three people who discovered it, Vanados, Teitelbaum, and Zanelli. It is a three-dimensional black hole. It is a solution, again, of Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant in three dimensions. It has the somewhat peculiar property that locally, the geometry is exactly the same as this anti-de-Sitter space. It differs only globally, because you've made some identifications. But those identifications are enough to give it all the causal structure of a black hole. And there's an exact analog. You have Hawking radiation, you have temperature and entropy and all of that. So this is very well studied. It is a somewhat simpler example of a black hole in three dimensions. Even in two dimensions, there's a black hole if you add some scalar field. So Witten wrote down a sort of model of a two-dimensional black hole with gravity coupled to scalar fields.